Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast, December 19th, 2016. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. You can follow me on Twitter at jpodhoretz. You can like us on Facebook at Commentary. You can follow us on Twitter at Commentary. At the table, Noah Rothman, assistant online editor, on Twitter at Noah C. Rothman, and Abe Greenwald, senior editor, on Twitter at Abe Greenwald. Gentlemen, as we speak, electors across the country are meeting to validate the numbers scored in the November 8th election. And after weeks of nonsense news about the possibility of faithless electors and the like, they are lining up exactly as they are supposed to. Electors who are looking like they want to play a different hand are being removed, and alternates being put in to vote as they are required to vote. And the only faithless electors so far, with I think more than half of the electoral votes cast across the country, are not casting their vote for Hillary Clinton. So this notion that somehow the Donald Trump electors could be seduced into invalidating the legitimacy of his election, at least a few of them, just to make the point that he shouldn't be president because of whatever reason, the popular vote margin or the Russian interference in the election proceedings, has been revealed as the latest fake news story to come out of the election. Abe Greenwald, you are a big fan or a big opponent or a big satirist of the sudden liberal obsession with the notion that conservatives live on a diet of fake news. What do you make of this fake news?
Well, really, since the election, there's been almost nothing but sort of, if not exactly fake news, sort of drummed up news geared towards invalidating Trump's election, beginning with the rash of stories of attacks by Trump supporters against Muslims and others. So many of those have been proved to be hoaxes. Moving on to the Russian hacking story, which is not fake news, but as we discussed last week, so little new information has come out on that was actually sort of has been billed as new information. And now this, and the best was today, the New York Times this morning ran one of their sort of what to expect columns about the elector vote today, which was great, as if there was anything to expect other than this.
Right. Well, I got into a little dust up on Twitter this morning with a Democratic political consultant who was outraged by the fact that a bunch of reporters down covering Trump at his resort at Mar-a-Lago agreed to an off-the-record meeting with Trump, which he talked to them for about 30 minutes, at which point Mike Allen, the sort of dean of the Washington Gossip Press Corps, now about to work for a new website called Axios, took a photograph or had a photograph taken of everybody who was in the group. And this was held to be a sign of, you know, sort of quizzling behavior by the press, who should not have agreed to an off-the-record meeting with the president-elect unless he agreed to regular press conferences, and how dare they even speak to him when he threatens the press. The ahistoricism of this is so astounding. Obama, during the run-up to the 2009 inaugural, had many off-the-record meetings in and around Washington with members of the press corps at various dinner parties. I know two or three people who were at different parties. And the notion that somehow the press should reject a private conversation with the president, by the way, maybe they should. Maybe the general rule should be the president shouldn't be in the position of having conversations with the media that aren't on the record so that everybody knows everything that he's saying. But to hold Trump to this standard when no president has ever been held to this standard, when John F. Kennedy 60 years ago was all but dictating what went on the front pages of the Washington Post because his friend and sycophant Ben Bradley was the editor of the paper. I mean, this just gives you an idea of the kind of ridiculous hysteria that has gripped people. The whole notion that you're not going to take a phone call from the president of the United States when he wants to call you and tell you that he's picking Rex Tillerson to be a secretary, or he's going to pick Jim Mattis, which apparently he did a couple weeks ago to various reporters. That's how they knew when they said Trump was going to name so-and-so something. It was because they heard from Trump himself. So that's also an aspect, not of fake news, but of the kind of emotional imbalance that seems to have gripped people in the wake of a very surprising election result that a lot of people really didn't want and really didn't think was possible. Noah Rothman?
Yeah, that's why we need some terminology here that I think is more helpful than fake news. Because there's stories that are foreign-sourced, weaponized misinformation, and then there's just some goofy Facebook post that some kid made up in Alabama, and then there are real legitimate news stories coming out of news outlets that are verifiable and reputable sources, but have no legitimate news value. They're what I called during the campaign dumb news. They're designed for emotional stimulation, confirmation bias, and that's a different phenomenon, and one I think that's even more pernicious, because it leads people into these alternative universes in which they are whipped up into this frenzy over who is the more zealous. It's a competition for anger currency, and that's sort of the pitfall into which Republicans fell in the Obama years, where they were attracted to the most vitriolic voice, and there was a competition to be the most vitriolic. The notion of things that were completely false expectations, unrealistic expectations, became standard norms, and if they were unmet, then it was indicative of traitorous intention, which I think we're seeing a little bit of here in the Electoral College situation. Right, idea that certain electors should be revolting, and if they can't achieve this thing, which they're literally unable to achieve, their votes are invalidated and they're removed and their alternate is put in there. They can't do that. But if they don't do that, this sort of rabid faction on the left will deem them insufficiently zealous for the cause of anti-Trumpism.
Right. Well, you know, part of this is also that there has to be a dynamic. The feelings about the negative feelings about Trump were exacerbated time and again over the course of 2016 by Trump himself reacting to stories and then overreacting or tweeting something that was really unpleasant or news about Trump or whatever, going after Khazir Khan. You can name 100 different things. Right now, he, and for the last couple of weeks, with the exception of a couple of tweets attacking SNL, you know, and Alec Baldwin's imitation of him, he has been quiet. He is selecting his cabinet. He is going through this process. And if the rage at him is not met by or added to or justified by current Trump behavior, the general attitude is going to start seeming a little unhinged. I mean, if he is altering his behavior now that he's become president-elect, that is something to be welcomed by everyone, it would seem to me, except people who really think that that can't possibly be the real thing.
What's interesting is that one of his faults and weaknesses has always been that he was at risk of always taking the bait. When someone said something to him or about him, he was never too big to be above anything, and he always responded nastily. Now he's sort of jujitsued that. I mean, in that he's got all of his detractors taking the bait and then some. I mean, they are absolutely apoplectic over him. And I wonder if he's going to, from this point on forward, while he's dialed it back a bit, if he's not going to leave enough inflammatory sort of evidence out there for them just to keep just so they can sort of keep themselves crazy and keep sort of overplaying their hand.
Well, you know, he won the presidency. He is the president-elect. He is going to be president of the United States. It makes sense that as it sinks in that this is actually going to happen, which it appears it is sinking in, that the not only the challenges and the, you know, the difficulties and the immense pressure of the job are coming across to him, but also the fact that he is now a much, much, much bigger person than he has ever been before. He may have thought himself to be big, or may have thought himself not to be that big, and that all of the bigness and all of the bigliness and all of that was a form of psychological bolstering of his own ego. Now he doesn't need any of that because he is who he always wanted to be, or he has reached the level that he was bragging about already having reached, you know, for 16 months during the campaign. And, you know, such a thing could calm a person down a little bit and make him say, you know, I don't need to fire off at this pipsqueak. I'm the president of the United States. Now, of course, then you get to the flip side, and we should now discuss the flip side of this, which is the question of the reaction times and the reaction to really important things, right? So as I said the other day, I wrote a column this week for the New York Post about how it struck me Obama, the consistency in Obama's foreign policy was underreaction, and the underreaction was a reaction. He was going to refuse to be baited by the things that were going on in history. He was going to do things the way he thought they should be done. And so he calls ISIS a JV team, and he does this. And he, you know, he doesn't act, right? So we're now seeing moments where there seems to be some pre-testing of Trump going on, or just by the nature of the world, right? This drone falls out of the sky and is taken by China. We have today the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey in Ankara, in full view of a lot of people, caught on video and photographed by an AP reporter. A really horrifying event, someone yelling about Syria. And we have Trump saying, the Chinese can keep the drone. And we also have no idea how he's going to react to this Turkey provocation. And we have a truck driving into a Christmas market in Berlin, which apparently has now, according to the latest reports, killed 9 people and injured upwards of 50, like the truck assault in Nice last summer. Another sort of mark of this new style ISIS attack, which is use whatever is to hand to just cause carnage, right? The Al-Qaeda method was the spectacular attack that shocks everybody by its size. And this is just, you could be anywhere and someone could drive a truck into you and kill you, particularly a summer resort or a crowded Christmas market or something like that. So we know that Obama would react to some of these in an almost insanely maddening way by saying we didn't know what motivated this. And so these are the events that could constitute an underreaction doctrine on Trump's part once we see how he reacts to it. Noah?
Yeah, well, I guess the pressures are institutional pressures are on him to sort of maintain that aloof, dignified detachment from reality, dispassionate, calculating executor of American foreign policy. I suppose that could be his impulses. But we did have evidence that old Donald Trump is not completely disappeared. He did take to Twitter late Sunday evening in order to express his antipathy towards the Chinese, I suppose, but in a very bizarre sort of indignant fashion. It was almost petulant. What did he say, Abe? He said that he wanted to let them keep the drone, like it wasn't that big a deal.
We should tell them they can keep the drone, they can have it.
Yeah. Right, so which is sort of bizarre. I mean, as far as we understand it, there's no classified intelligence on this. It's not like you can reverse engineer an underwater drone, but it's not like this is particularly classified technology.
I think the tweet came after China had already said that they're gonna give it back.
Right.
Yeah, so they're like, we'll give it back. He's like, yeah, you can keep it. keep the lousy drone.
So what's he trying to accomplish there? I mean, let's not impose on him some like grand strategy that's not evidenced by the facts on the ground.
Because I think that tweet is a very hard thing to game through. It's very hard to understand what he was thinking.
So
when
the simplest
he did it.
Explanation is he wasn't thinking at all. He just had a thought and expressed it.
Right, but what's the thought?
The thought is F you.
I don't know. That's
something
the thought.
I mean, look, his brain remains a black box, but if I had to do my best analysis here, I think it was something along the lines of wanting to tell China, if you think that this is going to get to us in any way, if you want to be noticed by me, I don't care. I'm not this. It'll take scarily. It will take more than this to get my attention. Now that's a potentially dangerous thing to say. It's not a clear message in any event.
Right. Well, so I think all of this raises the fact that when you are president of the United States, what consumes much of your time isn't the act of implementing your long-term agenda, even if you don't, if you have one. It is responding to unforeseen, unforeseeable, and unimaginable events that seem to take place nearly every day that you can't, you know, I mean, in the case of Barack Obama, it was, you know, there was the arrest of Skip Gates in 2009. There was the Deepwater Horizon, you know, pipeline blow up in 2010. There was the summer of the migrants coming across, the kid migrants coming across the border to Texas in 2014.
There was also in the summer of 2009, there was the Iranian uprising, the Green Revolution that really sort of threw a monkey wrench into his.
And then of course the biggest, which I, you know, didn't even think of, which is the Arab Spring. So things happen outside the can. You know, you may want to go around and cut taxes and have an infrastructure bill and do this and do that and do the other thing, and maybe the world will give you space, as it kind of gave Obama space to do some of that in 2009, 2010, in part because everybody was reeling so desperately from the financial crisis, which was still consuming everybody's attention, that you know, any activity on the part of Washington to alleviate or address these concerns was viewed in some quarters as very favorable. But in Trump's case, if he has an agenda that he wants to put forth, corporate tax cuts, whatever, you know, infrastructure bill, stuff for the white working class, his time, he will not be in control of his time. Presidents are not in control of their time. And to the extent that even you could say, well, a really good one is in control of his time. He picks and chooses what he wants to talk about, what he'll handle and what he'll focus on. And Obama did that, as I'm complaining about now with this underreaction doctrine. I don't believe that that's true. I don't think that there's any way for him to control it. And part of the problem is that we don't know what is going to upset the apple cart.
There's the whole notion here that we all struggle with, I think, that different isn't necessarily bad. And the conduct of American foreign affairs on Twitter is very different. We don't know whether or not it's entirely bad. If there was an example of this underreaction doctrine thing, while we're taking the high road, Ankara and Moscow are blaming this assassination on the United States. There are various networks within the United States and one cleric that they want extradited to Ankara. If Barack Obama sits on his hands and just says, well, that's ridiculous, no one's going to believe it. Well, I guess, but the Turkish audience will believe it. The Russian audience will believe it. Those who consume Russian propaganda, and it's a very broad network, they put a lot of money into their networks, they'll believe it. If Donald Trump were to put some sort of a counter-narrative out there, I would welcome it.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of things being different but not necessarily bad, the great scandal of the last 4 or 5 days in the eyes of the sort of mainstream media and mainstream American foreign policymakers and all this was the appointment of David Friedman as ambassador to Israel. This heralded has become a sort of a litmus test of a certain type about the Obama foreign policy, because Friedman is held to have views that are out of all acceptable boundaries. He is a supporter of the settlements. He is not a believer in the two-state solution. He will not serve as ambassador in the embassy in Tel Aviv, but will work out of a consulate in Jerusalem as preface to the moving of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. All of these things and more are considered so anathematic to the good working order of the Middle East and its peace process that there is a great hope among certain liberal types that his nomination will be contested and that he will go down, or it'll be a huge controversy. And all of that is ridiculous, and this is where it is beside the point where something different is happening that is not necessarily bad. Friedman is not the reason that Trump has decided to appoint Friedman. Trump is appointing Friedman because he is signaling a desire to upset the apple, to throw, play 52 pickup, throw all the cards in the air when it comes to the relationship of the United States, Israel, and Palestine, to say none of this is working, and we're going to try this very pro-Israel slant for a while and see if that breaks things through, or we're taking it because they're our friends and the Palestinians are their enemies and are acting like their enemies, and they're not our friends either, and so we're going to line up with our friends and punish our enemies. And that's Trump's policy. Friedman is only the vessel for it. And this is the sort of thing that, like the phone call to the Taiwanese prime minister, represents the kind of thing that an amateur can do that a professional would never do. And it could be a disaster, you know, because that's why professionalism exists, and you don't have amateurs running, you know, like taking over sports teams or whatever and then running the plays that they design. But it could also be the kind of creative, sort of a moment of creative ferment when you say, you know what, the Chinese-Taiwanese U.S. relationship doesn't make any sense now after 37 years where we're pretending that we don't recognize Taiwan and sell them $2 billion worth of arms a year. Or the Israeli-Palestinian peace process doesn't exist anymore, so we're supposed to pretend, we're supposed to live in an alternate universe in which we pretend that there is going to be a negotiation at any time soon, that we can't recognize that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel when it has been the capital of Israel for 70 years and will be the capital of Israel, you know, until the sands wear down the, you know, the tallest towers of Tel Aviv. I just think it's interesting.
Well, I think there's also a content form issue here in that Trump is breaking the norms of both. In terms of the content, if he wants a new approach toward China and a new approach toward Israel-Palestine, that's, from my perspective, very welcome. It scares a lot of people as well. Then there's also the form, tweeting out sort of quasi-policy impulsively. That's scary, I think, to virtually everyone, or at least uncomfortable and uncertain.
It would be welcome if it was part of a well-thought-out approach to policy. But at least when it comes to that Taiwan call, for example, it wasn't. I mean, we know it wasn't. There was no messaging strategy. They couldn't even decide who made the call. Everybody was arguing with everybody else. It was an impulsive move. They didn't know what the consequences would be because they didn't study it.
Yeah,
if we were going to shift to one China policy, we'd all welcome that. But we want some strategy there. We want them to have gamed out the likely responses and their responses to those responses. Similarly, if they move the embassy to Jerusalem without having gamed out what the response from the Muslim world is going to be, then it's not a well thought out policy. It's just impulsive.
Well, the devil's advocate play that I would make to that is, yeah, he's an impulsive and improvisational figure. He was elected for that reason, and this is how he is going to conduct himself. And it's like saying that you don't want, you know, you want, again, in a sports analogy, you know, you want Lawrence Taylor to be a quarterback, you know, or you want, you know, you want Justin Verlander to hit home runs. I mean, that's not who he is. He has a different way of doing things, and we're going to have to get used to it. Now, the consequences could be severe, and he should be criticized for them if the consequences are severe, but this is what the country voted for, and it has to play itself out to some degree, because we don't know what the consequences of the last 23 years of American policy toward Israel, for the most part, when we accepted the Oslo process and then let it go through, were wars, and a hardline Israeli attitude that says that peace will never be possible, and a concomitant view on the Palestinian side that peace will never be possible. So throwing that up in the air without a deliberate strategy to answer and counter the Muslim, it's never going to be like that.
Yeah, I understand that. But also, we knew Barack Obama's foreign policy was going to be bad. We said it at the time.
Yep.
We watched it be bad, as we predicted. It was bad. We criticized it when it was bad. It's not like these sort of things are something that we just have to throw our hands up and say, let's just see how this plays out
Obama's policy was bad because the ideas undergirding, supporting, and motivating the policy were bad. They were ideas about the United States and its place in the world that were bad. I don't know that the ideas that are behind the David Friedman appointment are bad, or that the ideas behind the Taiwan phone call are bad, and neither do you. Now, there are things that I think we are pretty sure are not good, like a real rapprochement with Russia is a bad idea. Russia is a bad actor. Putin is a provocateur. He is seeking to advance his interests in the Middle East against ours. He is an antagonist of ours. Any effort to find common ground with him is something that will give him an advantage and us a disadvantage. And we will say that. We've said it, and we will continue to say it. There is nothing wrong with looking at what is going on with Trump in this process and saying, wow, I'm just saying you can't, when I say you can't expect somebody to have a different approach to the world because he is not going through things in a prudent, calm, reasoned manner, gaming things that he will never do it that way. Whatever it is, that is not his game. His game is he is a negotiator in his own mind. He's a deal maker. And deal makers come up with a line, and then from there, everything gets fuzzy, and your goal is to conclude the deal however you can with yourself in the best possible position, or you walk away from the deal because the deal can't be done in a way that won't be injurious to you. So that's his approach. I'm talking from the perspective of somebody trying to look at this realistically about what it is that the United States is going to go through.
But that's not a grand strategy. That's not an American doctrine.
Who said it was?
Well, so to the extent that we think that's a good thing.
No, but
doctrines
arise over time. This is, I think, oddly you're being unfair here. The Reagan doctrine or the Bush doctrine or the doctrines that everybody can spell out, even the Clinton doctrine, these are things that evolved over the course of presidencies as a result of responses to real-world events. The Reagan doctrine, which was to support insurgent groups in communist countries with the hope that they could be encouraged either to overturn the regime or change the regime from within, that was something that it developed because of things going on in El Salvador and Nicaragua. He didn't go into office with that idea. It never occurred to him. It never occurred to anybody. The Bush doctrine, which was, again, the promulgation of the notion that we needed to change these countries from the inside, because without without democratic change inside them, the conditions under which they lived were going to encourage and promote more radical ideologies that would directly threaten us potentially with, you know, weapons of mass destruction. He didn't come into office with that. He thought he was going to do what Obama did, have a modest foreign policy that wasn't going to nation build and all that. So a Trump doctrine, to the extent that one can imagine one developing, is only going to develop as a result of the presidency itself. No one comes in with it.
Except the outlier, Barack Obama, who did essentially come in with the doctrine and stick to it, to his discredit.
Did. And Ronald Reagan was an anti-communist and aggressively so from the minute he started running for
public office. But Obama stuck to it so faithfully, no matter what changed on the ground.
A particular worldview. And yes, there was no obstacle that could deter Barack Obama from the Rand deal. There was a particular inclination that led Ronald Reagan to embrace military intervention in Latin America.
But that's my point. You can't look at Trump and say, as you look at all of these disparate things, one of the things that caused me to be fearful of him, of his candidacy, among many others, was the fact that during 2015, in those debates, he kept saying, I'm going to be even-handed between Israel and the Palestinians. I don't want to say who I like. I want to make a deal. It's a great real estate deal. That's what I want to do. And so I can't say I support this one. I can't say I support that one. Well, that's gone. He's whatever was motivating him to say that, he is now 180 degrees on the other direction. And if the hostility to China that he began hurling during the campaign in relation to trade and trade wars, if that is causing him to do for interesting things to go on in relation to the sclerotic policies that were promulgated in an effort to sort of brown nose China into not walking away from the, you know, early relationship with the United States by creating this fiction about how we didn't recognize Taiwan in 1979 by Jimmy Carter. How many presidents ago was Jimmy Carter? You know, AT&T was still a monopoly when Jimmy Carter promulgated the One China policy. You know, I mean, you know, there was like, we didn't have the internet then. There was barely any cable television. I mean, let's think about the world and where we are now. So bad things can lead to good results. Good things can lead to bad results. But you can't look at this period from November 8th until now, Noah, and say that the disquiet that a lot of us felt in the run-up to the 2016 election hasn't been tempered to some degree by the possibility that he's appointing good people and that he's willing to play around with policies.
No, I can't, and I have on multiple occasions in writing on this and multiple venues, I have. I also think that when you change a policy as pivotal as One China, you should have a strategy around that, and I don't think that's irresponsible to think.
I didn't say it was irresponsible. I just said that's what you think and that he's not doing that. So if you want to – You're elevating process.
This, they would have said both of them would have said who made the call. Yeah.
You know where there was a process? There was a process over recognizing Cuba. That was a process. Congratulations. Does it matter whether we had a process or we didn't have a process? It doesn't matter. We recognized Cuba. We recognized the Communist Party's totalitarian rule over Cuba. We recognized we dropped our human rights concerns in relation to Cuba. So I'm saying, like, you can get obsessed with the amateurism, and you should.
There are real consequences for this in the event that they haven't gamed this out. What people believe is going to happen is China will put pressure on Taiwan, which Taiwan wants. They want to draw us into this region. We've had this conversation before. They will lean on the United States in order to provide for their common defense. Because
look, if there's
to the campaign too. Every country that's our ally is waiting for Donald Trump to make good on his promises to retrench, and they are going to put the screws to him in order to make sure he can't do that.
If there is one thing that this year has made clear to us, it is that our capacity to game out the immediate responses to things that Trump does not entirely accurate. So I'm not. I am more modest in my view of understanding how the world is going to look at this, in part because it's weird. Like, so he's still, you know, gussying up to Putin, and he's throwing the Palestinians under the bus, and he's talking to Taiwan, and God knows what else he's going to do or how he's going to talk. Now they're talking about joint exercises after all this stuff with NATO and months of this NATO bashing. They're back to talking about participating in NATO exercises next year. So who the hell knows what's going on?
Yeah, I don't think we can't judge by much. I think he's nowhere near having a doctrine. And in his particular case, I think we should expect the unexpected.
Also, I think the problem, just to interrupt him one thing, is that his doctrine is everybody before me stank. They all sucked. Obama was terrible, Bush was terrible, Clinton was terrible. No one knew what the hell they were doing, and they drove the country into the ground. So by definition, you see, the problem with that is that frees him to do just about anything. Because, of course, Obama and Bush did radically different things with the same, you know, and so he can take one from column A, one from column B. He can do this, he can do that, as long as it's him doing it. Like, what if somebody does something and it really angers him? What if Putin does something in the third or fourth week of his presidency that is really insulting or offensive or does something like that? And suddenly he wakes up and says, I'm the president of the United States. I don't need to take this from this pipsqueak or something like that. Like, that's what you don't know.
That's actually the big fear, though, that Moscow has been under the impression now, based on this campaign, that they're going to have some latitude and they're going to test it. And Donald Trump is, of course, going to face institutional pressures from alliances like NATO. He can't just undermine NATO. It's just not going to happen that way. So it was the fear was always that Donald Trump is going to box himself into a corner when Vladimir Putin aggresses, and he will aggress at a time and place of his choosing. And the response is going to be, well, not grounded in anything that we could understand to be responsible deterrence models. It's going to be something, you know, vastly different. Maybe that's going to be super great. Maybe it spirals out of control. It's a miscalculation we can't stop. Those sort of things happen.
I agree.
We just don't know in his case. I mean, I think because he's not schooled in foreign policy and terribly much in history generally, he doesn't have a firm sense of what is institutionalized and what and what trends he's bucking when he bucks them.
I mean, I'm more – see, the interesting thing is if you were a real revolutionary, like if you really wanted to, drain the swamp of Washington, part of the problem was, say, picking somebody like Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is that he comes in from Texas. He, you know, was known two things in his life, which is Exxon and the Boy Scouts. Exxon's a very powerful, apparently extremely well-run, and he knows everybody. He knows a lot. He knows a lot about how the world works. But he knows nothing about Foggy Bottom. He knows nothing about how the State Department has functioned or how it's structured. And if he's got to deal with the internal problem of a foreign policy bureaucracy that is going to resist, as much of the Washington bureaucracy, resist the ideas and the change ideas of the president, the president is going to be ill-served by having somebody who has no capacity to force the building, as people call it, or Foggy Bottom, to his will, because he doesn't know it. He doesn't know its rules. He doesn't know how they stymie people. He doesn't know what models of interference they can use. And that's the amateurism problem, because you can imagine how it could be, you know, you have a president who says we could do X, Y, or Z, and then you go to somebody who actually has to implement the policy and has to know who to call in his building and who to say, no, don't play that game with me. We're doing this, or we're going to handle that, or we're going to handle something else. You know, when George Shultz was Reagan Secretary of State, he had been Secretary of Labor. He came in as a very relatively conventional Republican. Reagan, he began to see the outlines of the kind of transformation that Reagan could potentially implement in all sorts of places. And he had the bureaucratic skill to compel the State Department not to become a retardant to the innovations in Reagan's foreign policy. Trump, to the extent that he will have a foreign policy that is innovative, will have difficulty executing that. Maybe not the Pentagon, because he does have a real Pentagon head at the Pentagon, but we'll, you know, we can see how that, you know, how that will go. And we will also, poor Noah Rothman sitting here sick as a dog, needs to get home, so we're going to wrap up. And I'm going to say Commentary Magazine in its 72nd year as the preeminent monthly of ideas and criticism and policy and analysis. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you some free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.95 for a full year subscription digitally and $29.95 for a full-on all-access subscription that gets you also our monthly magazine in your mailbox. Right now, if you go there and you put the coupon code podcast in, you can get the digital subscription for $14.95 and the all access for $24.95. So it's a big savings for our podcast listeners in our fancy new studio with our regrettably ill producer and co-star for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.